Hey everyone, Scott here. I have a very special announcement, and I am excited about this one. If you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you may have listened to the massive multi-part series that I have done with co-host James Early, where we look at different key battles of American history. Key battles of the Revolutionary War, key battles of the Civil War, key battles of World War I. Well, James is launching his very own podcast, and it has that name in it, Key Battles of American History. And what he's going to do is show how war has played a key role in the history of the United States from the nation's founding right down to the present. War has made the U.S. independent and kept it together, increase its size, and establish it as a global superpower. And understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Well, if you have enjoyed those series, and I'm sure you have, a lot of people have commented on this show that some of their favorite things have been when James and I discuss things, you're going to absolutely love James' new show. He's already a few episodes into season one, and what he's doing is looking at some of his favorite movies about World War I. If you know James, you know he loves his historical movies. They include All Quiet on the Western Front, Gallipoli, Paths of Glory, They Shall Not Grow Old, Beneath Hill 60, 1917, Sergeant York, and others. James and I are already deep into recording season two of the series. We're doing a massive 30-episode or so series on the key battles of the Pacific Theater of World War II, and I really think this is going to be our best series ever. If you're listening to this episode the day I released it, which is February 17th, 2021, James is doing a giveaway to kick off the podcast. If you go to keybattlesofamericanhistory.com, you'll see how to enter the giveaway. We're giving away 5 3-month subscriptions to The Great Courses. This is an online learning platform that has incredible history courses along with language, health and well-being, cooking, really anything you can imagine. And it's been one of the best sources for James as he's been putting together all of the facts on the series we've done together. You have until Sunday, February 21st, to enter the contest. So again, go to keybattlesofamericanhistory.com to enter the contest. You can also subscribe to James' new show on any podcast player of your choice. To give you a sample of what it will be like, I'm going to play a little snippet of his episode on All Quiet on the Western Front, so I hope you enjoy.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome to a special episode of Key Battles of World War I. I'm James Early. This is the first of a projected mini-series of episodes in which a distinguished guest and I will discuss several of the best movies about World War I. In today's episode, we will discuss the classic, award-winning 1930 film, All Quiet on the Western Front. My guest today is a fellow history fanatic and World War I and World War II buff, Sean McIver. Sean is a co-host of the excellent podcast Come and Take It. He's also a major movie buff and a friend of mine, and I'm excited to have him with me. Sean, how you doing?
Doing well.
All right. Well, we're going to break this movie down. We're just going to run through it, and we'll be doing kind of a summary of what happens in the movie, and then we'll talk about, just give some commentary on it, talk about how it was received at the time, how it's stood the test of time, and what it says about not just the war itself, but about the author and the times in which it was written. So we're going to have a great time. This is a terrific movie based on a terrific book, and I'm really excited to be doing this. All right, so we'll start with some introductory information. The movie came out, as I mentioned, in 1930. It's based on the classic war novel, or you could say anti-war novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, written by Erich Maria Remarque. The book came out in 1929, and the movie came out the year after that, 1930. It's 2 hours and 32 minutes long, so it is not a short movie. It's, of course, black and white, like every movie just pretty much back in the 1930s. It was directed by the American director Louis Milestone, and it stars Lou Ayres and Lewis Wolheim, John Ray, and several other people. If you look on Rotten Tomatoes, it gets very high ratings, 98% from the critics, 89% from the audience. So very highly rated movie, seen by many, many people throughout the years. I mean, it's almost 100 years old by now. We're recording this in 2020, so it's a 90-year-old movie. But it's stood the test of time very well. And we are going to see again what it says about the war, what it says about people's reaction to the war. I should say that Remarque was he was a veteran of the war himself, so it's partly based on his own war experiences. Sean, did you want to add anything to that introductory section?
No, it's an extremely famous film and one of the all-time classic films.
Yeah, that's why we're starting with this one, because it's if you think of World War I movies, this is probably the one that comes to mind. I should say also, before we jump into the movie itself, there was a remake made in 1979. It was a made-for-TV movie, and it starred Richard Thomas, who was most famous for being John Boy in The Waltons, and also Ernest Borgnine. I actually saw that movie in high school. I was in a world history class, and the teacher showed it. So that was my first experience with All Quiet on the Western Front. I hadn't seen the 1930 one until this year. I've seen it twice this year now.
Yeah, I saw it in college, the original one, in a college film class, and that's probably the last time I've seen it. Although I had seen for years before references to the movie in World War II books, specifically the American Heritage Pictorial History of World War II. There's a section on anti-war films and sentiment before the war. So, and that one specifically mentioned. I did want to add that Louis Milestone is actually a Russian who immigrated to America before the First World War. His birth name was Lieb Milstein, and he was born in Bessarabia in Russia. So, but he anglicized his name to Louis Milestone and became a Hollywood director.
All right. Well, that's fascinating information. Now, let's go ahead and jump into the movie itself. So I have divided the movie just for my own purposes to make it easier to attack it, take it one bite at a time. I've divided it into 8 parts, and these aren't technically scenes or anything like that necessarily. I guess you could consider it that way, but we're just going to call them parts. This is
segments.
Segments. This is just my division, and Sean agrees with me. So we'll start with the beginning. That's a good place to start always. And so the first part takes place in 2 locations. It takes place in a schoolroom and then also in a training camp. And in the opening scene, we see a bunch of young men, probably 18 years old or so, they might be advanced high school students. They're in a classroom, and they're teacher is called Professor Kantorek. And the professor, the war has broken out. It's early in the war. The professor urges his students to join the war. He gives a great speech, whips them into a frenzy, tells them they need to go out and serve their country, and if necessary, even die for their country. And he quotes a Latin saying, which is dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. That was a famous, a very common statement made back at the time, which means in English, it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. And the boys all jump up, or young men, I should say, they jump up and they're all fired up and ready to go march off and serve the Kaiser, except for one. There's one student named Bane who is reluctant to join up, but being with peer pressure and everything, he finally agrees to sign up. Remember that name, Bane. We'll talk about him a little bit more later. So the main character is a man named Paul Baumer. Paul Baumer is played by Ayers. And the other new recruits, they march off, they report to the barracks, and there they're greeted by one of the, I guess, the bad guys in the movie, one of the antagonists, a man named Himmelstoss. Himmelstoss had been the mailman in Paul's hometown, but he's now a corporal, I believe, and he's one of the people that's tasked with training the new recruits. And his authority that he's been given kind of changes him a little and turns him into this mean, tough, kind of in some ways like a stereotypical drill sergeant like you see in a lot of military movies. But even worse, he's kind of developed a cruel and sadistic Edge, and he confronts the new recruits. He orders them around. He drills them in a humiliating way. He's constantly making them drop down into the mud and get up, and then he gives them a ridiculously small amount of time to get cleaned up. And
he's
so
a Martinet.
He is a Martinet. And the boys, I keep calling them boys. They're really young men. When they finally have enough of it, and they realize that he's gone off to a bar. And so they lie in wait for him by the side of the road. And when Himmelstoss is coming home from the bar, he's pretty much blasted. He's inebriated and he's walking along. They grab him, they cover his face, and they beat him. And then they run off. And so they get the reward against good old Corporal Himmelstoss.
Yeah, it's a Himmelstoss. And actually, there's a scene very early in the movie when there's troops marching through the town and everybody's cheering. Yay. I believe someone mentions it seems to imply it's about 1915 because they've talked about that they nearly have beaten the French and they've nearly beaten the Russians. So I think it implies that it's somewhere around 1915. The initial fighting has already been going on. The war is already going. But the Himmelstoss is the mailman and he's delivering some mail to his shop owner. And the boys, a couple of the boys kind of run up and grab him and tease him. And they seem to be teasing him. And that's how they treat him when he comes into this camp, barracks, because he told the shop owner, "Oh, I've been called up as well. I'm a reservist." And which is interesting because he was not called up in 1914 when the war started. And he didn't volunteer in 1914 when the war started, when they invaded Belgium and France. He waits until 1915 when they call him up when they need some more resources. So, but yeah, they tease him in the town, and then later that's what they tease him when he walks in all puffed up in his Prussian uniform. And that's what sets the antagonistic relationship with them. So I just thought it was interesting. The Himmelstoss, I don't know what Himmelstoss in German means, but it was an interesting name. And I thought, I tried to look it up, but I couldn't really find a good translation.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's one of the themes of both the movie and the book. I should say, it's going to be hard for me not to refer back to the book. I'm going to try not to that much, but the book is just so great.
I've never actually read the book. So
I just recently re-listened to it on audible.com, but I'll tell you what, it's much better than the movie, which is usually the case. And whenever a book is made into a movie, they're not always able to get in all the things. The book is very psychological. A lot of it is Paul's thoughts about the war and about his own life and about other people. And that's just hard to convey into a film. In the film, there's a lot of chit chat between the different characters, Paul and all of his various friends that join up into the army. And then Paul meets new friends that are not from his hometown, and they do a lot of back and forth dialogue, and that's just made up. That's not in the book. But
90 years later, it's hard to see the scene with the professor and the scene with the young men all rushing off to join, and the scene with Himmelstoss with this first section. It's hard to see this and not remember that this wasn't the stereotypical portrayal. This was the prototype. This was the one of the very first movies that really the book was one of the first stories of really calling to attention this the older generation without a stake and without their own risk sends young men off to war. It entices them, in fact, to go off to war to die. This is 1930. The film had only been around for 30 years, 35 years. The sound had only been around for 3 years. So you look at that and you now are like, oh, that's kind of I've seen that scene before. Well, this is the first scene that this really was seen.
Yeah, we've seen it a million times because of this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
It really set the standard for the, I guess, anti-war, for lack of a better word, a movie that questions war instead of celebrating.
Yeah, the critical right. Portrayal of war.
And Himmelstoss, both in the movie and the book, is kind of the embodiment of one of the themes of both the movie and the book, and that is that you can take a regular person, but as soon as you give them authority, you know, put a stripe on them or two stripes or three stripes or put a, you know, an eagle on their shoulder or whatever, and they turn into a different person sometimes. You talked about how Himmelstoss had been kind of picked on in the hometown. Now he's going to give it back. He's going to turn around and pick on others. He was this humble mailman back in the hometown, and now he wants everybody to know that he is the boss, and he's going to let you know that he's always going around saying, aren't you going to salute a superior officer? Aren't you? How are you going to talk to a superior officer? Things like that. So
yeah, and he's just a corporal.
Yeah, yeah. He thinks he's this big deal.
Yeah.
He himself is going to get ordered around later on. Just one fun fact, too. I got to mention this again. I'll try not to refer to the 1979 one too much, but Himmelstoss in the 1979 version is played by Ian Holm.
Oh, what a great
And he's really good, you know, as he always is. He just passed away a few months ago. And of course, Ian Holm for me will always be Bilbo Baggins, but
yeah. or the android from Alien.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, we gotta work in Lord of the Rings to every movie somehow. Lord of the Rings reference.
The 1979 movie definitely has more stars. It's Donald Pleasance and Patricia Neal are also in it.
Right, yeah. All right, well, so we've set the stage here. Let's move on to the second part. Now they've gone to the front. And once Paul arrives at the front, he meets some of the soldiers in his company. One of the people he meets, and this is going to be the other major, major character besides Paul himself, is a man named Stanislaus Kat-Kaczynski. And he is a master. He's an older man. He's about 40 years old. He's a master of finding food, which is always a plus when you're in the army. And I didn't even mention, Sean, that I kind of took it for granted that the listeners know this, but they might not know this. This is about the German army. This is told from the German point of view.
Yeah.
And so if you know your World War One history, you know that as the war progressed, it got harder and harder to find food in Germany. The British put a blockade around German ports, and they pretty much interdicted any kind of war supplies that might be coming in to the country, including food. And so food got increasingly scarce, both for civilians and for the military. And so we even see this in the movie. They do a great job of showing this, that at the beginning of the war, food is sometimes scarce, sometimes not. But by the end of the war, it's always scarce. Mm-hmm. And even Kat later on is going to have trouble finding food. But at the beginning of the movie, which is probably, as Sean mentioned, around 1915, this fella Kat, he just goes off, he wanders off, and he comes back with, you know, lobsters. Was it crabs? Lobsters. He came back with lobsters one time. He came back with a pig another time. And so he's a good man to have in your company.
It's yet another, I mean, your point is good, because not to derail things, but that's yet another point that remark would make about the futility of war, because we also know that by 1917, the British were starving too, because of the U-boats. So
yeah.
Mutually assured destruction. Everybody was going to starve to death because they were strangling each other mutually.
Yeah. Except for the French.
France was a breadbasket of Western Europe. So they had lots of farmland. Germany didn't have as much farmland and they didn't have as large a population as France did.
Right. One other detail I want to mention is that I appreciated from the movie is they, at the beginning of the war, the German soldiers are wearing the Pickelhaube. That's the helmet with the spike that everybody thinks of, you know, the stereotypical German helmet. And then later in the movie, as the years progress, they show them in the other helmet that they switched to later on, the Stahlhelm. Steel helmet, which was a much better helmet. The Pickelhaube was made out of leather.
Not really a helmet.
If you're fighting somebody hand in hand, you don't want to have something they can grab. and pull your head down and then, you know, cut your throat or something. But
you also don't want to have leather on your head when, you know, shrapnel shells are bursting overhead.
Right. Yeah. Leather's not a very effective form of protection. No. That's right.
And that scene when they arrive at the front is very interesting to me, because it was, you know, they had left the rigid Prussian order of the training grounds where they marched and marched. And that's really all they did was march in formation. And then they get to the front and get off the train, and it's chaos. It's absolute mind-boggling chaos. And they're being shelled by the French artillery or the British artillery, whoever's shooting at them. And one of the soldiers even gets killed. One of the young men gets killed as he's getting off the train. Like, he didn't even get to the front. And they've already lost one of their number. There's no officers. There's no one there to lead them. They don't know where to go. And so, again, it's the chaos and futility and madness of war.
Yeah, they do a great job of showing that, too. I remember the scene. Everybody's going every which way. Some people are coming. Some are going. There's no order at all.
Yeah, and this is not the immediately they're confronted with. This is not what we were cheering for back home. What they were being told back home was that it was this nonstop victory. And immediately they're confronted with this thing is going very badly.
Right. Yeah. Reality bites. All right. So Paul and Kat and the other members of the company, they're sent on a wiring detail, which means to put up barbed wire. To me, that would be one of the worst jobs. I mean, nobody wants to be in a war. All wars are terrible. World War I is especially bad, but I think this is double especially bad because you're so close to the enemy lines. And sure enough, they get attacked. And the young man who was reluctant to sign up that we talked about earlier, Bane, he is blinded and he straggles about. He's trying to figure out where he is and he's trying to get back to the lines and he's shot dead. So that's doubly tragic because this guy didn't even want to go in the first place. And he's the first one, well, the second one to die. And Paul holds the teacher personally responsible for that. Later, they get back to a bunker in the German lines and they're playing cards. They're fighting rats. They're dealing with the stress of constant bombardment and lack of food. Some of the soldiers even begin to go mad. One of them tries to run away and they can't stop him. And so Kat finally just slugs him, knocks him out. You have to punch your own guy. Sometimes you have to beat up your own men to keep them from going out and doing something really stupid.